It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For the third time in a little more than a decade, the state legislature is considering allowing a hunt for sandhill cranes. The state Senate Committee on Sporting Heritage held a public hearing on the bill yesterday.
Sandhills were nearly eliminated from Wisconsin a century ago, but the bird is a conservation success story, with its population growing to an estimated 110,000 in 2023 in the eastern part of the country.
That recovery hasn't gone unnoticed by farmers around the state. They're especially problematic for corn farmers in the spring. Wisconsin's corn and potato growers estimate the birds cause about $2 million in losses annually. Many farmers and lawmakers are calling for a hunt to manage the population.
And we'll hear from a conservationist in just a bit about what threats the bird still faces and what alternatives there are to a hunt. But first, we turn to Representative Paul Tittle, a Republican from Manitowoc, who is sponsoring a bill to create a sandhill crane hunt. And last year, Tittle chaired a Legislative Council study committee on sandhill cranes to review and recommend legislation on the management of the birds. Representative Tittle, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a great privilege.
You proposed this bill that would create a sandhill crane hunt. You also authored a bill to hunt cranes in 2021 that didn't advance. What is different about your bill this time around?
I think the biggest thing about the difference of this bill versus previous bills, we studied it very much in depth. Ledge Council Study Committee, we met over five times. We studied the habits, the habitats. We studied the sandhill cranes. We brought in U.S. Fish and Wildlife. We brought in people from the DNR. And it was a very comprehensive study. Nothing really ever gets done like that on a bill, usually just a regular bill that comes through our legislative offices.
How are your constituents being affected by cranes?
Well, the constituents are being affected. A lot of farmers have contacted us and basically told us that in the spring is the worst. And we had testimony yesterday talking about up to, I think it said 14 inches. They'll pull out the seed. And I know that there is a seed coating called Avapel. Mm-hmm. It is expensive and you can put it on. Well, actually, the farmer has to figure out how to put it on. Either they can put it on themselves or hire somebody else to put the coating on. The biggest problem we've heard when we had testimony from farmers was it wasn't that Avapel didn't work. They do not like seeds with Avapel on it, but they spit them out. So they could still, they'll go down a row and still destroy a lot of corn plants before they realize, wait a minute, this isn't a very good lunch for me today.
Hmm. Wisconsin is estimated to have about 51,000 sandhills. A management plan calls for a hunt when the population reaches 30,000 to 60,000. But then some conservationists fear that's too low. If a hunt greatly reduces the population, would you be in favor of ending it?
Well, first of all, I don't know where the information you're getting on 50,000 is, because we have a sandhill crane count of 2023 of over 110,000.
Which is in the eastern part of the country, of which Wisconsin is included in, yes.
We're in the eastern flyway, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so there is U.S. Fish and Wildlife actually regulates all of our hunting, so they would actually shut it down before I would even have to shut it down if there was ever a problem, because U.S. Fish and Wildlife will look at it every single year and determine. They do it the same thing with other migratory birds like geese and ducks and what have you. So every year they look up and they set standards and they set the bag limits on everything. So I'm not even concerned about whether I'll have to get rid of the sandhill crane hunt, because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, if it was detrimental, and I'll tell you what, if it was detrimental to the sandhill cranes, I wouldn't want to be hunting them either.
Hmm. The state doesn't allow farmers to be compensated for crop losses unless a hunt is permitted, as you know. Why not change state law to allow compensation instead of pushing for a hunt?
Well, the compensation, and a lot of people don't understand this, this is not just general tax dollars that for the compensation for wildlife damage. Compensation for wildlife damage comes from people buying hunting and fishing licenses, and there's a surcharge on some, and that's where the money comes from. And so we would literally have to upend Wisconsin government, because I guarantee you, as soon as we start paying out for crane damage from our general fund, all the hunters and fishermen will say, well, why are we paying for it? You know, and they're not. So there is a balance. I don't think we could do that that way.
Would you have enough tax dollars to put into a claim fund to cover all of the farmers' losses from the cranes?
Well, it's only estimated now because they cannot get anything. They cannot get any reimbursement. So it's only estimated, and we will definitely take a look at that and make sure that we are compensating the farmers. I don't know exactly how the compensation works on deer and bear and turkey and all that other damage, but I guess it would probably have to be looked at very in-depthly.
Representative Tittle, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. And one last thing I would like to say is that Wisconsin's Constitution says that we have a right to hunt and fish. It's actually in Wisconsin's Constitution. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, that is a key thing that a lot of people don't understand is that U.S. Fish and Wildlife said we could have a hunt. Now we're trying to get a hunt, and the Constitution says we should be able to hunt.
That is Representative Paul Tittle, Republican, who represents Manitowoc Area District. Now for a different perspective, we turn to Ryan Michalesko, the Communications and Advocacy Specialist with the International Crane Foundation, which is based in Baraboo. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Sandhills have almost vanished from Wisconsin, but they've made this remarkable recovery. Why do they still need to be protected?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think the important thing is that we note that this was less than 100 years ago that famed conservationist Aldo Leopold estimated that there were 20 pairs or fewer sandhills left in Wisconsin. So while it's a conservation success story, that narrative can change rather quickly.
More than a dozen states, including our neighbor Minnesota, allow sandhill crane hunts. How are those hunts affecting the population?
Yeah, you know, this is something we hear a lot. And in fact, the matter is that 17 states do allow a hunt, but most of those states are in the Central Flyway, which is more than 10 times the size of that of the eastern population that we have here in Wisconsin. So a lot more birds to go around. The other thing that's really unusual is that Wisconsin's a critical breeding area. We're different than those states. In the eastern population, Tennessee, Kentucky, in Alabama have hunting seasons, but they're not breeding grounds. What we do here in Wisconsin in terms of these birds that are long-lived, they take a really long time to breed. They're not always successful at hatching and raising young, maybe one or two chicks a year, maybe none. And that's definitely a concern. The other thing I'll say is that the International Crane Foundation was founded more than 50 years ago. And for 30 of those years, we've been studying sandhill cranes here in Wisconsin in a long-term breeding area, long-term monitoring project, where we banned our sandhill cranes, and we really spend a lot of time monitoring them, learning their behavior, where they go, where they come from. And what we saw this year is a 32% reduction in the sandhill cranes that returned to that breeding ground. And in that same area, only one in five breeding territories produced a chick. So that's really concerning for us. We think the cause could be the highly pathogenic avian influenza that we're seeing. Probably about 4%, and that's likely an underestimation. Birds were lost in this population just this spring from the flu.
Farmers are currently unable to be compensated for crop losses unless a hunt is authorized. Are there better ways to protect the crops?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's non-lethal options, and I think that's what farmers are really looking for here is some help with those options. I think that we heard ample testimony, and I wish the representative would have stuck around to hear the DNR testimony yesterday, because we heard from the DNR representative, the migratory game bird biologist, that a hunt is not going to resolve spring crop damage, and a reminder, a hunt would occur in the fall, and also that a hunt would open that damage abatement program that the representative mentioned, but the DNR also said that a hunt on sandhill cranes would completely deplete that program for the farmers that are already receiving compensation for things like deer and turkey.
So if not a hunt, then what?
Yeah, you know, the governor put forward a really wonderful proposal in the spring that was going to be $3.75 million that would have gone directly to farmers to help them with this issue, a cost share. You know, they want skin in the game, too, and this would have helped them purchase that seed treatment and other abatement measures. However, that was really quickly stripped out of the budget, unfortunately. And what we see now is really, frankly, an abysmal approach to both of these bills. They operate at massive deficits. SB 112, as proposed, would lose $400,000 a year. That's the bill out of the study committee, and it has a lot of great things for farmers. But the other thing that we didn't hear a lot of yesterday is the proposed substitute amendment that's coming from Chair Staffschult of the committee. That bill strips out all of those great things for farmers and then would lose an additional $1.6 million. So the math really doesn't add up. This isn't a good bill for cranes, would risk the population, would put whooping cranes at a huge risk, and additionally, it's going to lose money and cost Wisconsin taxpayers.
Explain the threat there to whooping cranes, if there would be a hunt.
Yeah, you know, whooping cranes are also a remarkable species. There's fewer than 700 in the wild flock. And here in Wisconsin, we're really fortunate to have the reintroduced eastern migratory population, of which there are only about 70. Whooping crane numbers got very low at the same time as sandhill cranes, but even much lower than sandhills. That means we lost most of their genetic information that we're working really tirelessly to bring back. So If one whooping crane, which we have seen poached by a hunter or accidentally misidentified, is lost, that sets us back decades.
Wow. So could the crane population ever get large enough to warrant a hunt?
I think that's something that we have to wait and see. I mean, these are things that, of course, as the representative said, the Fish and Wildlife Service studies, but also the management plan that many of these decisions are based off of is 15 years out of date. So we need new information. We need to understand novel threats like avian influenza and how those impacts are affecting the population. You know, just in Europe in the last month, they've lost 40,000 or more Eurasian cranes, which are a very comparable species, both in the crop damages that they cause, but also in their biology and their spread. If we lost 40 or 50,000 sandhill cranes in the eastern population, that would be more than half the population in the matter of weeks.
Very quickly here, going back to what you said at the beginning, why is Wisconsin such a critical breeding ground? What makes us different?
Yeah, you know, we're very fortunate to have the wetlands that we have so successfully preserved, but at the same time, those wetlands in many cases bump up to the agricultural areas that used to be native grasslands, and that means that we have the perfect home for cranes to nest and raise their young, but that also means that that home is right next to the food source they also need.
Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Ryan Michalesko is Communications and Advocacy Specialist with the International Crane Foundation. And earlier, we heard from State Representative Paul Tittle, who proposed a sandhill crane hunting bill.
Coming up, the federal government shutdown caused some strains in air travel. Find out why a shortage of air traffic controllers is a long-lasting concern.
There's this lag time in the system where even though they're ramping up their hiring efforts, it's not going to show up overnight.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The longest federal government shutdown in American history may be over, but challenges for air traffic controllers and the aviation industry remain.
In the midst of the 43-day shutdown, Transportation Secretary and former Wisconsin lawmaker Sean Duffy said the country was losing 15 to 20 air traffic controllers a day to retirement.
What does it all mean for air travelers here in Wisconsin? Howard Hardy is an aviation reporter with Flight Global. Howard, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on the show.
We had this shutdown, longest in U.S. history. What big picture do you see as its legacy, if any, for aviation?
Yeah, so the government shutdown had prompted the Trump administration to mandate a 10% capacity reduction across 40 of the USA's largest airports. And this was designed to ease the pressure on our strained air traffic control system. You know, anybody not living under a rock is probably familiar with that situation by now. ATC workers were not getting paid during the shutdown, adding sort of a financial dimension to what is already a taxing profession. Some controllers were calling out sick while others were stepping down entirely. And this led to traffic flow problems at big airport hubs. I was on a flight a couple weeks ago that circled San Francisco for an extra 45 minutes before we touched down, and the airline attributed that delay directly to the ATC shortage. And, you know, most people who traveled during that period likely had a similar experience, spending more time taxiing before takeoff or, you know, more time waiting to land or having their departure time delayed. There just weren't enough ATC personnel to sort of clear the queues. But, you know, at least partially due to the optics of the shutdown causing these travel issues out in the real world, the shutdown is now over. Airline operations have returned to their normal levels of delays and cancellations, which is to say that there are always some, even on good days. But what I think is interesting now is how the shutdown standoff could affect airlines and the ATC situation moving forward.
Right, because before the shutdown, I understand there were concerns about our air traffic controller workforce, not enough of them, people retiring, obviously a stressful job. The shutdown was an acute, you know, look at that problem. It hasn't magically gone away, though, right?
No, exactly. So the shutdown happened in this longer-term context where we just haven't had enough ATC workers in the U.S., and more specifically in the Northeast, in cities like D.C. and New York and Boston, really busy hubs up there. This has been a longstanding issue. Airlines have been calling for some kind of action to address this shortage for years. And the Trump administration has made a big hiring push. They've set some ambitious staffing targets, created incentives for signing on, and they've tried to streamline the training process to shorten the time it takes from the application stage to being, you know, like a trained independent controller, which does not happen overnight. By the way, this could be like a 3 or 5 year process, right? In fact.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. This is not something you solve quickly. If I decided to, rethink my career, A, they wouldn't have me probably, but B, if they did, I'm not in that chair for a long time, right?
Yeah, exactly. It is a rigorous process. They have an aptitude test that they give you, and even if you do qualify, it takes you quite a while to be an independent controller out on your own. You have a shadowing process for quite some time as well, where you're working with a qualified, experienced controller. So there's this lag time in the system where even though they're ramping up their hiring efforts, it's not going to show up overnight.
At the other end of the pipeline, there were concerns about air traffic controller retirement going up during the shutdown in particular. Have we lost people toward the end of their careers who we might have had around for maybe another 3 or 5 years while we train up some new folks?
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, whom you're familiar with in Wisconsin, he said that, you know, they were losing 15 to 20 controllers daily to retirement during the shutdown period, compared with the usual rate of more like 4 or 5 daily retirement. So clearly attrition increased rather sharply. And it sounds like some of their hiring gains could have been negated, but to one extent isn't immediately apparent. I think what the shutdown really did was put a spotlight on how stressful being a controller can be. You know, hundreds of lives are at stake and you're managing these complex airspaces with just so many moving parts. And then there's this extra layer of the pressure from coming on high. You know, the president is taking to social media to sort of blast controllers who weren't clocking in. In some cases, questioning their patriotism for taking sick days or what have you. So whether the shutdown has any sort of effect on the FAA's recruitment efforts and their ability to staff the ATC towers of the future will be an interesting question. You know, did this episode really sell people on this career path, or does it seem too high stress? It's kind of hard to say right now in the big picture, but that will definitely be interesting to watch.
When people look at this issue, I think nationwide, they might be thinking about, you know, the biggest hubs for air travel. Here in Wisconsin, we've got, you know, an airport in Milwaukee, pretty good size, not a major national hub. Then Dane County and Madison, a couple smaller passenger airports. How have you seen things shake out for, you know, smaller regional airports when it comes to air traffic control? Is this a big airport issue or is this an everywhere issue?
I would say it's mostly a big airport issue. You know, the measures that the administration took to ease pressure on hubs was really focused on those 40 biggest airports in the United States. And so when we're talking about how air travelers in Wisconsin are affected, I would really think about, you know, people catching connections at O'Hare in Chicago. So when I tend to think about, you know, the ATC shortage and how it's affecting everyday travelers, I normally think of, you know, flow through these really big, busy, congested hubs like Chicago.
is there any kind of sense that, you know, we are safe, we are less safe in the air because of these problems now? We had that crash in Kentucky. It was a cargo plane. I got the sense that it wasn't an air traffic problem. It was an equipment malfunction. What do we know about safety given these challenges with air traffic controllers?
You know, there really are lots of aviation safety incidents around the world every day. I don't want to downplay people's concerns. I think that has always been true to some extent, although there are more planes flying today than ever. And I think people are just more aware now, you know, with the rise of social media and everybody being able to become their own crash investigator. The U.S. had that long period, though, of no fatal accidents on commercial aircraft prior to the PSA Airlines Black Hawk crash at Reagan Airport in D.C. I feel like since then we've been sort of shaken awake here in the U.S. You know, airline safety certainly isn't something to take for granted, and these tragic accidents can help us avoid similar outcomes in the future. So I hope that the reality of what can go wrong helps airlines and aircraft manufacturers and regulators and indeed ATC controllers. I hope they can, you know, kind of tighten up their respective operations and try to avoid these outcomes. On the note of safety, I just visited Airbus's factory in Toulouse where they have an aviation safety center. And one thing they said there really stuck with me. In the early 1990s, they had something like 300 or 350 aircraft flying globally. And now that figure is more like 16,000 aircraft. So there are just more commercial aircraft out there, which means more opportunity for accidents. And Airbus was really emphatic in saying that it would be unacceptable to maintain the same rate of accidents as they continue to scale up the global fleet. That would just translate into a noticeable amount, an increase of accidents. And really nobody wants to hear, you know, rate statistics after a plane crashes. So I think we just need continuous improvement, or the public simply will not accept the safety risks.
Now, the FAA lifted all those restrictions on commercial flights we were talking about earlier in the wake of the shutdown ending. That announcement came out on Sunday. Was it easy for the airlines to go back to full capacity there, or did it take some time to get back to what standard operating procedure?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. The airline cancellations and delays got a lot of coverage. And I understand why. It's a really clear example of government dysfunction kind of spilling over into the real world and affecting everyday travelers in a practical way. But relative to some other stuff that trips up airline operations, you know, like recent examples being technology outages, bad weather, or labor union action, the shutdown didn't really register as a crisis from our perspective as aviation reporters. A 10% reduction in air traffic isn't an emergency relative to, you know, Air Canada just shut down 100% of its network over the summer because their flight attendants were on strike. And compared to Southwest Airlines had this complete network meltdown over the 2022-23 winter period, which caused something like 17,000 flight cancellations. So the shutdown period was meaningful and people's itineraries were disrupted. We've all been there and it stinks, but maybe it was a bit oversold as this like apocalyptic event. So to answer your question, airline operations have resumed more or less as normal. Like I mentioned earlier, we still have some delays and cancellations. What is interesting, I think, is that we're seeing a suppression in bookings further out. It appears that the shutdown has had a negative effect on air travel through the Thanksgiving holiday period, which is, you know, really supposed to be a boom time for airlines. So it's kind of bad news for the airlines that are hoping to put some of the earlier year struggles behind them.
Howard Hardy is with us, aviation reporter with Flight Global, looking at the impact of the shutdown, concerns about air traffic controllers, and other issues affecting passenger airline travel. Howard, you just teased what I wanted to ask next. Looking ahead at the Thanksgiving holiday, you just mentioned people haven't been booking as much. What does that mean? What are the numbers we're talking about? How short are airlines falling from what they might have expected?
Yeah, so we look at this data provider called Cerium, and it's something we often reference as reporters, and that says that domestic bookings are down about 3% relative to the same period of 2024. And it appears that bookings have slowed in general, which, as I mentioned, is bad news for U.S. airlines. They had recovered pretty nicely from the low period earlier this year. You might recall when everyone was holding their breath to see if tariffs would send the U.S. into a recession. Those fears really suppressed air travel to and within the U.S. But then airlines bounced back relatively quickly. They're all fairly upbeat during their third quarter earnings calls. A lot of U.S. carriers were saying that they were feeling pretty good about the final few weeks of the year. But now it looks like they're looking at a significant year-on-year decline in bookings, at least in the very short term. And as I mentioned, you know, this is a big deal because Thanksgiving Sunday is the busiest air travel day of the year. But we'll have to see how it goes through the holiday, and we might see a rebound by the time Christmas and New Year's rolls around.
I assume these are raw enough stats that we don't know the why behind them. It could be, well, gosh, I'm scared by this news I'm hearing from the shutdown or air traffic controllers, or it could be inflation, economics, I don't want to spend the money now. I'm guessing that information is we're still waiting on.
Yeah, I think it would be fair to say that every time there's a big event, either, you know, with the economy or the government, it kind of shakes consumer confidence and airline spending, particularly leisure travel, is one of the first things people cut out of the budgets if they're feeling a little uncertain about the future and their money-making ability. So I would put this phenomenon in that same bucket where I think maybe U.S. consumers are feeling a little uneasy about spending over the holiday season, and that would probably at least partially explain the suppression in air travel bookings.
Now, Spirit Airlines announced it'll drop service from Milwaukee, among other airports, starting in January. I know airports tweak their services all the time. How big a deal is that? Is that something that they're going to feel the loss, people who fly through Milwaukee, or do you anticipate other airlines might pick up some of that slack?
Yeah, that's actually happening all over the country right now. Spirit is going through its second bankruptcy proceeding in less than 12 months. They've had a really difficult period of contraction where they're furloughing pilots and flight attendants and cutting aircraft out of their fleet. And they've totally exited about a dozen U.S. markets, including Milwaukee. And yes, I do actually expect other carriers to step up and kind of fill the void. We've seen Frontier Airlines, one of their biggest rivals, has been really open about stepping into markets recently vacated by Spirit and kind of capitalizing on the distress of their competitor. We also see some startup airlines like Breeze Airways and Avelo Airlines. They have also moved in on markets when Spirit moves out of them. Another player to keep an eye on would be Allegiant Air. I'm not sure how much interest they would have in Milwaukee in particular, but generally speaking, the airline industry abhors a vacuum, and I would expect another airline to step into Milwaukee and kind of fill that gap.
One other piece of news I see, the Trump administration rolling back some Biden-era rules for consumers. One would have offered compensation when passengers face significant delays. Are these changes significant, as you see it, for air travelers?
I think that, it was kind of this unusual tack that the Biden administration had taken where they were, advocating for consumers that have really gotten the short end of the stick for a long time when it comes to receiving compensation for canceled flights and the expenses that occur when you have to stay in a city that you weren't expecting to, and you have to spring for a night in a hotel and Uber fare and all that. And really what Trump is doing is kind of a return to normal where consumers have limited means for recompensation when it comes to disrupted itineraries. I think it is a big deal for consumers, but I'm also not sure how many consumers were aware that those protections were available over the past few years.
Looking ahead, what is the big story you're watching for, especially in commercial passenger air travel?
I'd say the thing that I follow most closely is the state of the low-cost carrier sector in the United States. That has been the most interesting from, kind of an analytical perspective, because they've been under pretty intense pressure. The major carriers, Delta, United, American, they have really dialed in low-cost products of their own. So they sell cheap seats in the back of their aircraft for rates that are similar or maybe even undercutting the low-cost carriers, so that they can offer seats to passengers for maybe even less than Frontier and Spirit in some cases. And that has placed a lot of pressure on the existing low-cost carriers. But at the same time, those carriers I mentioned before, Avelo and Breeze, they seem to be having success flying smaller aircraft to these kind of underserved cities, rather than challenging big airlines kind of head-to-head in really big markets flying into the most popular cities in the U.S. They're targeting these sort of under-the-radar markets with smaller aircraft, and it seems to be a formula that's providing them some success. And so I think the thing that I'll be following, as you know, especially as Spirit is going through a really difficult period of contraction, whether new players like Avelo and Breeze rise up and become more formidable players in the market and really give the major carriers a run for their money.
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Howard Hardy is an aviation reporter with Flight Global, formerly, by the way, with Wisconsin Watch. We've been talking about the needs and challenges for air traffic controllers in the aviation industry, what it all means for travelers here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, a museum exhibit in West Bend shares the work of Frank Lloyd Wright with the story of the hundreds of chairs he designed.
He has 5 to 6 decades of furniture production, starting here in Wisconsin at Taliesin, that we think established Frank Lloyd Wright as much as a furniture designer as an architect.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin-born architect Frank Lloyd Wright is most famous for his building designs, including the Guggenheim Museum in New York City, Falling Water in southwestern Pennsylvania, and Taliesin near Spring Green.
And Wisconsin is home to more than 40 houses, churches, and other buildings designed by Wright.
But Wright also left his mark as a furniture designer, bringing his signature style to more than 200 chair designs over the course of his long career.
Now, the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend is uncovering this history with a new exhibit putting Wright's chairs in the spotlight. The curators say that these artifacts were long overlooked.
Eric Vogel is an independent curator and architecture historian. He was previously chair of the 3D design department at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. And Thomas Zolinski is architecture and design curator at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Together, they're the curators behind Frank Lloyd Wright Modern Chair Design. Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And Eric, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Eric, let's start with you. I think if people hear the name Frank Lloyd Wright, they're thinking buildings. But he's done all this work in furniture design that tends to be overlooked. Give us a sense of the kind of work he was doing and how influential he might have been.
That's really amazing that so little is known about Frank Lloyd Wright as a furniture designer. You know, he has over 800 pieces of freestanding furniture that he designed in his long career. And yet most of us think of him as an architect or even a landscape architect or an interior designer before we think of his furniture. And then the furniture that most people do know is his earliest period, his Prairie period. And many people have seen the furniture that is at his home and studio in Oak Park, or in some of the houses that he designed in Illinois, like the Dana House or the Martin House in Buffalo. But really, he has 5 to 6 decades of furniture production, starting here in Wisconsin at Taliesin in the years before World War I, that we think established Frank Lloyd Wright as much as a furniture designer as an architect.
Thomas, walk us through this exhibit at the Museum of Wisconsin Art. What are we going to see?
So you're going to see a lot about what Eric was talking about. There's this kind of biographical aspect to Frank Lloyd Wright that we noticed was quite instrumental to the type of work that he was doing, both architecturally and furniture design. While we say that the exhibition is not a survey of his design, we do have works. The earliest work is starting in 1903 and ending in 1959. So Wright did design for almost 7 decades. That's a very long career. But we represent almost 60 years spanning that career, showing those works in mostly a chronological setup in the exhibition. The exhibition is organized by different movements, kind of centered around the different Taliesins, his home and studio in Spring Green, and then when Wright opens his second location in Scottsdale, Arizona at Taliesin West.
Eric, follow up on that. How does the layout of the exhibit match those different schools of thought that Wright might have been working through?
Well, it's really exciting for us to discover drawings in the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation archives that depict pieces of furniture, specific pieces that we have in the exhibition. And sometimes these were pieces that were lost to time. For example, where only one photograph was known of that piece, no drawings exist. And it was destroyed in a fire, in the first fire at Taliesin. So many people had forgotten, you know, it's understandable because that fire in 1914 and the scandals surrounding it, the murders, the loss of family, the employees killed, those very naturally sort of overshadowed, eclipsed the way that Wright healed from those tragedies. And he healed by working even harder, by rebuilding Taliesin, by experimenting even more. So what we see is iterations at Taliesin of extremely experimental furniture, much of which has been forgotten. And so Thomas, I think, will talk about the recreations that he did. I would just say it was really exciting to discover drawings in the archives. For example, the reconstruction floor plan for Taliesin II. So when the original buildings at Taliesin, built in 1911, 1912, burned in 1914, Wright immediately began drawing new floor plans and re-envisioning the ceiling, really creating a new interior architecture. In the floor plan is a new chair, a broad-backed armchair that very clearly resembles the Little House armchair that we have in the exhibit. And so we believe that, like Gerrit Rietveld in the Schrader House, or like Elver Aalto in his house, or Mies van der Rohe with his chair designs, that actually Wright was looking at new compositions, a new way of building his architecture by experimenting with furniture design. So we think that there's a strong likelihood that the armchair for Taliesin II actually helped generate design ideas for the new architecture at Taliesin.
Thomas, Eric mentioned reconstructions. Now, I might imagine an exhibit like this, like, okay, we're going to find existing pieces, and then we're going to have drawings that never got built. Well, hang on. You took some of those drawings and had some of these chairs made that might never have actually made it to the production stage. What kind of things did we end up with?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, when we started the project, we had a list between 1 and 200 chairs that, you know, after going through the archives, we said these are really important components of Wright's design trajectory. And in that, Eric is like, you know, there's this chair in 1911 that's burned, you know, we lose it in a fire at his house. And then there's this project where he designs 3 chairs for the same client, and the evolution in one project is important. However, they weren't ever fabricated by the client. And then we have works that, you know, weren't ever built, or so we thought, but a different client had fabricated them. So all of a sudden, we're looking at the project and we said, you know, the main body of work in the exhibition is on loan or drawn from various collections across the country. So we have 30 historic objects on loan from 15 different institutions. And then there's 11 designs that we fabricated over the last year. that represent kind of those holes in that narrative of his design. You know, we could have, there's many more that we could have fabricated, but we had to kind of look at the list and say, which are the most important that really help us tell the story? And like Eric was saying, there's some very important works that he had designed and lived with at his own house that obviously were very important to write, and they represented kind of a specific moment in his life. And so we recreate those works, and they're on center in the exhibition. And part of the project, you know, we were learning through doing, which is kind of what Wright did himself. So even, you know, in the ethos of how Wright practiced, he was constantly reinventing and being innovative and experimental. And we kind of got to go through a little bit of that process as he would have during his lifetime. But doing that today is kind of, you know, somebody said in a tour the other day, I learned from, you know, the people I'm giving tours from, and they said it was kind of like an archaeological project. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what it was. And I shown together with the historic works, it really tells quite a unique and intriguing story that really we wouldn't be able to tell without bringing those pieces back to life.
Can I riff on that for just a second? Because there was an exciting moment in the exhibition. You know, I had spent 2 years as scholar in residence at Taliesin West, deep in the archives in this kind of archaeological process that Thomas was talking about. And at one point, the museum director, Laurie Winter, said, Eric, I mean, this is a great story, but this can't be an academic exhibition. This has got to have a real hero. This has got to have something that really will bring people through the door. And I thought, okay, well, I did discover a drawing for a cafe chair at the Guggenheim. I think Wright designed it when he was 90 years old. It's never been fabricated. I don't think many people know that he designed furniture for the Guggenheim. We could reconstruct one of those. And so at the end of the exhibition, we start literally, as Thomas said, in 1900, 1903. At the end of the exhibition, 1959, Wright is 92 years old. We see him create a chair in spun aluminum, a material that I've never seen a piece of furniture made from before. We have shop drawings and his concept sketches for this from 1959. So it takes Wright from the arts and crafts period to the space age. It was incredibly exciting to find those drawings, to go through the shop drawing process with local manufacturing. So the guys at Butler Metal Spinning couldn't have been better partners. And the chairs that they did for the exhibition are just outstanding. They're really showstoppers.
We're talking to Eric Vogel and Thomas Zolwinski, co-curators of the new exhibit, Frank Lloyd Wright, Modern Chair Design. It's at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend through January 25th. Thomas, when I've talked to people about Frank Lloyd Wright building design, his deal kind of was, I'm designing this building to go in this landscape a lot of the time, right? And so you couldn't make this building in another place. Was there something like that with these chairs? I am designing these chairs for this house, maybe for this specific room.
There was and there wasn't, and that's a very good question. And I think that was kind of something that was discovered through this process of this being a really research-oriented project. You know, Wright's working in organic design, so this holistic approach to everything blending and working together and very specific, that started to break down, especially in his Usonian house projects, where we started to see that he's designing furniture that actually can go between different projects and still work. And that also speaks to that innovation that Wright was interested in. You know, Eric was saying we have fumed oak arts and crafts, very rectilinear. Then we have the very triangulated period where he gets into plywood. Then we get into the folded plane, and then we get into the circle where he introduces metal at the end of his career. So there's really the story of innovation. And a lot of times, you know, that is working in tandem with the architecture. But, you know, after looking at what we see in the exhibition, you start to see really Frank Lloyd Wright as this furniture designer, even more so than a lot of practitioners that are specifically furniture designers.
All right, Eric, these chairs are objects of design and art. They're also chairs. Are they comfortable? Would people want to sit in these things?
That was a great discovery. And I will say that is one of the benefits of building these recreations, is that we worked with extremely talented cabinet makers who built one-to-one prototypes or mock-ups for us. So, for example, Stafford Norris in Stillwater, Minnesota, who is a consummate craftsman, was responsible for the entire reconstruction of the Willie House in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We worked with him on the three early chairs, Taliesin 1, Taliesin 2, and the Ingalls House armchair. And he very kindly made one-to-one scale mock-ups out of a soft pine. And we looked at them in absolute detail to the shadow line. And of course, we sat in them. And what was so great is that I had my favorite. So the Taliesin 2 armchair, I sat in and fit me perfectly. And it has a wide seat, these low, wide arms, and a wide horizontal backrest. And Thomas was sitting in the Ingalls chair, which was even earlier, slightly higher stance, which fit his body better. But we both looked at one another with these big smiles and said, how can people complain about Wright's furniture? It's really a change. It's a big transition from his Prairie period, where men and women were not ever casual at the dining table. They were sitting corseted. The men had starched collars. They were formal. They were not ever sitting against the back of their chairs. Or if it was for a moment. So there was decorum and protocols that almost prevented the chair design from being comfort oriented. And right, there's a definite shift as we move from that Prairie period to Taliesin. And it's this sense of ergonomics. And you even see in some of those early armchairs where he made the back tilt. It pivots on a metal hinge to hit the back even more directly in line with the shape of the spine. So we discovered quite a bit of comfort with Wright, but with this caveat that as many times as he was working towards something that was comfortable for his clients, often at his client's request, he was really, the chair was a problem for Wright. He thought that sitting was an undignified position. And so he searched his whole life for a form of chair that would actually present the human body in a dignified way. And we see that with his origami chair in the exhibition. He felt that it didn't fold up the body, that it presented the body in a very dignified way.
And Thomas, you've been through this experience now, this doing this exhibit, getting some of these prototypes made. Has it changed the way you think about chairs, not just in art design, but in our daily lives?
You know, that's a really good question. And from a design perspective, I did study 20th century design in my master's program. So, you know, I have looked at lots of chairs and kind of looked at this from a fabrication standpoint in the past. And what I was kind of awakened to is this idea that while he designed and then created hundreds of chairs and freestanding furniture, he wasn't interested in mass production until a couple experiments later in life. But he's really using localized economy. He's looking at using materials from the region, and he draws on craftspeople that he knows. And it's really kind of a craft approach to fabricating that he carries on for decades, even when that's not really what is supposed, you know, that's not a hot button issue. He's doing that as the way that he practices furniture design.
I'll leave it there. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
And Thomas, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks. This was great.
That was Thomas Solwinski, architecture and design curator at the Museum of Wisconsin Art, and Eric Vogel, an independent curator and architecture historian. They're the curators behind the new exhibit called Frank Lloyd Wright Modern Chair Design. It is currently on display at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend, now through January 25th. Speaking of West Bend, in coming days we'll hear from a restaurant owner in West Bend who years ago started a tradition of hosting a big community Thanksgiving meal.
The meal is made possible by many volunteers and open to the entire community with the goal of bringing people together and ensuring that no one spends Thanksgiving alone. And now the free dinners are in partnership with four West Bend area churches.
Are you involved in some kind of community meal where you are? Do you volunteer or have you participated in some kind of community meal? Do you have a special memory to share of one of these gatherings and how it felt?
Get in touch with us ahead of the interview. We'd love to hear about your story. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Joe Tarr, Royce Podeswa, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.